Just a couple of introductory words. I'm trying not to tread on Bernie's toes in what I say, but the interesting thing about Lamentations is that it may be a bit of an unknown book to a lot of the Christian church, but it's quite traditional in Roman Catholic liturgy to be read during the last 3 days of Holy Week, because the book describes not only Jerusalem's destruction, but it's also about the profound theological lessons that we can learn from the book. And Orthodox Jews customarily read it aloud all the way through on the ninth day of Ab, it says here, which is the traditional date of the destruction of the first temple and also Herod's temple in AD 70. And it's often read at the Wailing Wall in the old city in Jerusalem as Jews remember their past. So, with no more ado, Bernie, bring Lamentations to us.
I think that's the shortest introduction I've heard Graham do. But yeah, my wife will turn around to you and say that I'm the most negative person you can find, and it's not surprising I'm doing this book. I'm not one for poetry, so it's a learning curve for me, because it's a unique book, this one, and it's poetry, and yeah, I did poetry at school, but poetry at school was there just to get you through an exam. For me, the only poetry I've read since was a guy gave me a book and said, "You ought to read this, Bernie, it's exciting stuff." I did, and it was interesting, but still didn't get me onto this idea of poetry. So we come to the Book of Lamentations, which is 5 poems. Great stuff. And the author is, I've written down here, but you can all correct me, I'm sure, is anybody's guess. It's normally traditionally said it's Jeremiah who wrote it, and that is purely from the fact that in Chronicles 35 there are references to Jeremiah uttering a lament for Josiah. But other than that, I'm not aware of anything that says it was him who wrote it. So the fact that the authorship may be in question does not affect at all the value of the book, the value of what we're going to look at tonight. And it's a book about disaster, about misery, about doom and gloom. It's a book about everything negative you can think of or experience in life. But it talks about how people felt. It talks about how they approach God. It talks about deliverance and forgiveness and all sorts of things like that. So yeah, I hope that you'll enjoy listening to it, and I hope it'll inspire you to go home and pick the book up yourself and say, right, I'm going to read that because it sounds really interesting. In our Bible, it's sandwiched between 2 really big books. So it's between Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And if you ask anybody, have they read Lamentations, the answer will be no. And the chances are it's because they flick through the Bible to find something to read. And of course, it never falls open on Lamentations. I asked our pastoral group who's read the book, and they all said, no. I can't understand why not. It's fun. It's enjoyable. And I hope some of that will come out. But in the Hebrew Bible, it's grouped with Ruth, Songs of Songs, Ecclesiastes and Esther. And they're known as the 5 scrolls. And each book is associated with an annual celebration or event. And as Graham has suggested, Lamentations is to do with the fall of Jerusalem. So this is a big, big event in the story of the Jewish nation. It concerns a siege of roughly 575 BC, of Jerusalem and what happens in it. If you want the history of it, turn to 2 Kings 24 or Jeremiah 39 and you'll pick up the historical picture of what was happening. But this is an incredible catastrophe in the history. And it's something that last month, those of you who are listening or here, would have realised that Jeremiah warned them about it. Said, yeah, sort yourselves out, or else there's going to be a big catastrophe coming, or else there's going to be something really nasty going to happen. And it does happen, and it's a significant event. And we see a picture of Judah going from being an important part of the Middle East, a country that had status and power, to something that is really just unimportant. So God had promised Abraham a land. David had fought to build up the kingdom and Jerusalem as its capital. There were the lines of the kings coming down. And in Jerusalem itself was the centre of God's presence in the temple. We get a picture of priests who maintained rituals for the worship. We get a picture of everything centering around Jerusalem. And then Lamentations comes and you get a picture of it, total destruction. So Lamentations is about pain. It's about confusion. And it's about how people react. If you see me throw bits of paper on the floor, it's simply because I don't know what else to do with them. But it might be because I get fed up and just throw them away. But question is, what is a lament? And you all know the answer, I'm sure. But yeah, it's a form of protest to start off with. Yeah, crying out, drawing people's attention to something that is wrong. Yeah, why is this happening to us? And in particular, trying to attract God's attention. Say, look, God, why is this happening to us here now? It shouldn't be tolerated. It's a way of processing your emotions. Yeah, I don't write things down, but some people will keep a diary and write down how they feel and things that have happened to them. And in this way, God's people have an opportunity of venting their anger. They're absolutely blown away by the fact that, you know, Jerusalem has been destroyed and it's been caused by their sin. A lament is also a place where you can voice confusion. Because when you go into these dark places, perhaps you don't understand why you're there. Why is this happening to me? Yeah, perhaps you're saying it should be somebody else, but why am I here? Why am I going through this? And sometimes in this we start to question the character of God. Now, all of this is okay. Yeah, there's no problem with it. Yeah, we've got a right to question God's character. We've got a right to cry out to God and say, why is this happening to me? So it's okay, but in a sense, Lamentations brings a sort of dignity to it all. It's not just a crying out for the sake of crying out. It's this appealing to God. God is always in the background, reaching out to him. So we move on to look at the design of it. And you may think this is going to be a really long introduction before we get there, but I find the design is one of the things that makes it so confusing to read. If you remember, Graham last month was talking about Jeremiah and he said, oh, it jumps about here, there and everywhere. Lamentations, the way it's written, the first four chapters are an acrostic. And they take the 22 letters of the Jewish alphabet and put them down, and the first word in each verse starts with the following letter. So if I said to you, what is grace? What are you all going to shout out to me? Favor. That's it, right? You all got there in the end. God's riches at Christ's expense. And that is true, but it's not quite the truth, because it misses out things like this, God's unmerited favour. So we'll call it G-R-A-U-C-E. And you see, it gets confusing doing that. Grace is nice and easy and a simple way to remember. But Lamentations doesn't do much for us as you read it in the English version, because it just doesn't seem to follow any pattern. But yeah, there is a pattern to it. There is a sense to it. But in a way, it provides really limited way of expressing things, because you have to keep on trying to work out what word can I use with this letter. So let's move on, and forgive me if I sort of jump around a bit in this, but the book starts off with how lonely sits a city that once was full of people. How like a widow she has become. She that was great among the nations, she that was princess among the provinces, has become a vassal. She weeps bitterly in the night. Wow, we start off with this picture of, it talks about a lady, and this is looking at the city of Jerusalem. And it's just a focus on the grief that is going through this city. And you can see straight away, it has contrasts in it. This is what she was like, and this is what she's like now. And this goes throughout the whole of Lamentations, contrasting the positive in a sense and the negative. And straight away you see this picture of a city that has just fallen from, oh, I was going to say grace then, but perhaps that's not what I meant, but a city who once was something but now is nothing. She sits alone, bereaved of loved ones. And there it's talking about the fact that she makes alliances with other people, she has false gods, and all of these things that she found her support in, that she found guidance from, have suddenly disappeared and become her enemies. And in a sense, if you look at verse 4, it says, the roads to Zion mourn, for no one comes to the festivals. And for me, that just reminded me of the number of references in the Old Testament to people flocking to Zion to worship God, and now there is no one. It talks about her gates and her walls and everything, and that fact that the gates were there not just to protect the city, but it was a place where people came for civil courts. There, the elderly men, but not necessarily elderly, sat and they discussed things. People came for judgments to be made. So the gates and the walls were all sorts of things that were for protection, but also say something about the sort of civil side of the country. It talks about priests no longer performing their religious duties. There's lots of things here which just focus on the fact that everything has collapsed. Everything that held the country together has disappeared. And those people that are left are very much sort of, what are we going to do? Could you imagine if Medway Council disappeared? It's tempting, isn't it? But yeah. If the police just disappeared, yeah, we would end up with a place that I wouldn't want to be in. We would end up with disorder. And this is what's happening in Jerusalem, that all that held it together, both the civil law and the religious side of it, have just disappeared and gone. It talks a lot about her enemies, and it says that, you know, that they come and they mock her, that they're all laughing at her. And in verse 5, it says, her foes have become the masters, her enemies prosper, because the Lord has made her suffer. So the writer here not only is talking about what's happening, but he recognises there's a reason for it happening, and that reason is God has made her suffer because of the multitude of her transgressions. And so we get this whole picture, don't we, of a collapse of society because God has allowed it to happen. Now, this for the Jewish nation could be a new revelation, because, like, if you're a Christian, we all know that we are all sinners. That's taken for, yeah, that's part of being a Christian, recognizing who you are, but recognizing we have a Savior as well. But for the Jewish nation, they were special people. They were God's chosen. God had led them out of Egypt. God had protected them. God had provided for them. God had led them into this promised land. He'd cast that. Yeah, God, yeah, he just loved them so much. There's absolutely no possibility God could let anything sort of evil happen to them. And yet suddenly they find that God has allowed this to happen. They had this sense of false security, and now it's disappeared. In verse 10, we see this. Enemies have stretched out their hands over all her precious things. She's even seen the nations invade her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter your congregation. This picture of not only sort of the walls being knocked down, but yeah, the temple was a place where Gentiles could only go into the outer courts. For folk like us, we couldn't enter any further, especially if you think about the Holy of Holies. It was restricted to the priest who was in charge for that day. He was the only one allowed in there on special occasions. And yet now we've got this picture of Gentiles coming in to the temple and plundering it, of taking away the treasures. The heart of their religion, in a sense, had just been torn out. Was anything worse going to happen to them? But God, in verse 12, it says, "Is it nothing to you, all you pass by? Look and see, is there any sorrow like my sorrow, which was brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger?" God allowed it to happen. And you can imagine the people there. How can God allow this to happen? How can God just sort of stand back and watch these invaders come in? I'm going to skip now to chapter 2. What I should have said earlier is that what you'll find is Lamentations as repeated themes. You'll get doom and gloom all the way through it, and it will look at different aspects that come up again and again and again. So if I jump past a group of verses, it's mostly because I'm going to mention it later. But chapter 2, if you wanted a heading for it, is "What Has God Done?" And "How the Lord in his anger has humiliated daughter Zion. He has thrown down from heaven to the earth the splendor of Israel. He has not remembered his footstool on the day of his anger." And if you read through it, certainly in my version, I've highlighted he has. Yeah. He has broken down the strongholds. He has brought down in dishonor the kingdom and its rulers. He has cut down all the might of Israel. He's withdrawn his right hand. It's just he has. Putting across this fact that this is God at work, but his method of doing it is through the Babylonians. God is allowing them to do these things. So what has God done? He's brought disaster upon them. And certainly chapter 2 looks at the measure of the disaster and distress that the people are experiencing. And you may ask this question, have we got a God who is angry? People often say, oh, yeah, God is a God of love. But the word for anger, the phrase is here, destroyed without mercy. Talk about God's wrath. And, you know, we often sort of think of wrath and anger as something that suddenly happens. I don't know about you, but now and then I get angry. I'll tell you a little story because that'll make things a bit easier for you. But when I was working, there's two guys who, not Christians, they would often discuss the church. And so I was sitting there trying to do my work. Everybody else was in the team. And these two, loud enough for everybody here, would discuss, you know, Christianity, you know, talk about how Christians are weak-willed and all this lot. And they were talking about Jesus one day, and all of a sudden, will you shut up? You know, if you want to talk about it, talk about something you know something about. Whole room went silent. My boss said, Bernie, would you like to come out? He took me out. Are you all right, Bernie? I said, yeah, I'm okay. It's just that I got to that point where, yeah, I just got so angry with these guys talking about Jesus in a way that was dishonouring and totally wrong in what they were saying. I just exploded. Well, God, yeah, God's wrath here, it's not that sort of big explosion because he suddenly got angry. It's something that's happened over time. It's been building up. And we talk about Israel and their special relationship with God, a covenant agreement, and just go back in the history of Israel and you find that they've been violating this agreement over hundreds of years. They've been worshipping other gods. There's been injustice, there's been oppression of the poor. And God has slowly just got to that point where suddenly he felt he had to do something. It's not something he did, you know, spontaneously, you know, just like I did, you know, sort of got a bit angry. But it's something that the time had come that God was going to step in and do something. The time had come when he had to sort his people out. So in verse 2, we see all these things that he's done. He's become like an enemy in verse 4. Oh no, that's sort of verse 5. Verse 3 talks about withdrawing his right hand, which is basically talking about the power of God stepping aside. Not that God could stop these things happening, God could, but he chose to let the Babylonians come in. And God is seen as this one who's allowed these things to happen. He's broken down his booth like a god. He's destroyed his tabernacle. He's abolished Zion in festival and Sabbath. And it goes on. You know, God has done all these things. He's done this. He's done that. And the list goes on and on and on. And then in verse 9, you hit this point. It says, her gates have sunk into the ground. He's ruined and broken her bars. Her king and princess are among the nations. Guidance is no more, and her prophets obtain no vision from the Lord. And this again is something that comes up in several places where the prophets, those that remember Graham last week, last month, standing here and talking about the prophets. And in Jeremiah, you've got Jeremiah pronouncing this sort of doom and gloom upon the nation. And you've got other prophets who would say, hey, folks, don't worry. Things aren't that bad. Yeah, he's got it wrong. And here he's talking about the fact that the prophets, the religious leaders here at the time, no longer get vision from the Lord. He has withdrawn. He has separated himself from his people. So it's a pretty disastrous place to be. In verse 11, we get a new person speaking. It says, my eyes are spent with weeping. My stomach churns. My bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of my people, because infants and babes faint in the streets of the city. We see this picture of somebody is just sort of, well, literally being sick over what they're seeing and what they are experiencing. Mothers cry, where is bread and wine, as they faint like the wounded in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out in their mother's bosom. Yeah, this whole picture is one of a city that is under siege. Now, I've never been under siege. I've been without food now and then. But this whole picture goes on and on in chapter 5, I think it is, or no, maybe 4. I might miss it. No, I'll leave that until we get there. But yeah, this whole picture of literally what is happening as people are slowly starving to death, slowly sort of they've got no water to drink and just are dying, and things get worse and worse. It's a pretty poor picture. And we get again in verse 14 this picture of the false prophets, deceptive visions. They have not exposed your iniquity. False and misleading oracles. And then launches back into this whole idea of people passing by, clapping their hands. When I read that sort of thing, it reminded me of Jesus. Literally of people who were laughing at him on the cross. This is the same sort of thing. People passing by, people coming up to the walls and laughing at what they have gone through. But in verse 17 of chapter 2, it says, the Lord has done what he proposed. He has carried out his threat, and he has ordained long ago. He has demolished without pity. He has made the enemy rejoice over you and exalted the might of your foes. So you get to that point again where you recognize who brought this disaster upon them. And then verse 18, you suddenly get this picture of somebody who knows that there is possibly a bit of hope. Cry aloud to the Lord, O wall of daughter Zion. Let tears stream down like torrents. I suppose somebody might start singing the song in a minute, but let tears stream down like torrent day and night. Give yourself no rest, your eyes no respite. Arise, cry out in the night, at the beginning of the watches. Pour out your heart. So we get this picture of disaster and what's going on. Now we get a picture that, yeah, perhaps he's suggesting there is a possibility of hope. Perhaps God might relent. Perhaps things might get better. But yeah, again, it just disappears into pictures of verse 20. Look, O Lord, and consider, speaking to God, to whom have you done this? Should women eat their offspring, the children they have born? Should priests and prophet be killed in the sanctuary of the Lord? Yeah, crying out to God and saying, look, should this happen, God? Why have you let it happen? And again, it goes on to talk about the day of your anger. I'm going to skip now to chapter 3. He says, as you may have guessed, I've stopped reading my notes because I find them terrible. I hate being stuck on something. But chapter 3 again, I think I might have been reading the wrong verses actually. I thought you were looking all confused, but never mind. Chapter 3. I am the one who's seen affliction. This personal picture comes back to us again. It breaks the design that I mentioned earlier, because now we've got 3 verses per letter. But other than that, it's still this voice of a lonely man speaking out of his suffering and grief, his doom and gloom, as a representative for all the people. And we're reminded in this that in the midst of all disasters, suffering is really a personal thing. Yeah, a nation may suffer, but it's the individual that is really the one that is attacked. But again, I know what I've done. Because I wasn't reading the notes, I'd gone on to chapter 3 without realising it. Never mind. But what I wanted to turn to in chapter 3, because there's this sort of doom and gloom. Anybody here watch I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here? Oh, you wonderful people. I'm forced to watch it because my wife watches it. And I think it was the last series, there was a phrase that people use, like somebody be locked in a box with snakes being dropped in. They'd be crawling and they'd be going, screaming out, and somebody would be saying, think of your happy place, think of your happy place. And they'd all sort of imagine some place where they were happy to try and focus away from what's going on. And you sort of read this and you think, there is no happy place. It's so black. In verse 17 of chapter 3, it says, I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, gone is my glory and all that I had hoped for from the Lord. The thought of my affliction, my homelessness, is wormwood and gall. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind. And suddenly verse 21, this is the only real bit of hope in these five chapters. This is a bit where suddenly he starts thinking about God. And verse 22 and 23, I know you know it from the song, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And all of a sudden, the writer sort of lifted out of his distress and the pain and the suffering and focuses on God. He focuses on God. This is his happy place. This is his happy place. And in a sense, yeah, it's weird, isn't it? How can we, when we are suffering so much, escape from it and say, God has done this to us, but God is the one who can rescue us? It just seems a bit weird that this God we've been condemning for so long suddenly becomes somebody that we see a bit of hope in. It's a dark, dark place he's in. There's a quote here from Spurgeon's, which may help some people. He says, yet, dear brethren, that is, on the other hand, the sweetest thing about our trial, because if the darkness be the place where God has led us, it is best for us to be in the dark. Not my language. What he's saying there, you may be in the darkest, darkest depths of suffering or whatever you're going through, but if it is God's plan for you to be there, it's the best place for you to be because you're at the centre of God's will. And this really is part of the story of Lamentations, that they are in the darkest, darkest depths of wherever they want to be or wherever you could be, and yet that's God's will that they are there. So it must be the best place for them. It's one of these weird things in life, isn't it? It's not the place I'd want to be. It's not the place we'd choose to be. But it's God's will. And therefore, it must be the best place for them. So the writer says, the Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. There is hope in God in this dark place. And then he goes on to say, the Lord is good to those who wait for him. It is good that one should wait quietly. It's good for one to bear the yoke in youth. And a few sort of phrases that are really positive, that are really saying, look folks, when we're in these dark places, maybe we'll sit down and quietly just think about God, quietly think about our situation, and just in a sense, you know, we would turn around and sort of suggest that people go and just take time out and quietly be with God. That's exactly what he's saying here. Yeah, take the time out. Because what he's looking at, and again, it's one of these difficult things to grasp hold of, that if God is a just God, and this is his justice in practice, that they're being punished for all the evil they have done, that is just, we have a God of mercy as well. And if he is a just God, then surely out of this situation, God may be merciful. This brings hope in this difficult situation. Things could have been worse, perhaps, but God, out of his love, may come and rescue them. And yeah, there's this just time in this book where you sit down, you think, wow, there's hope. There's that light at the end of the tunnel. There's the fact that they're not completely destroyed and consumed. There's still life. And when God leaves some life, there's also hope. We always talk about the remnant, don't we? You know, look at the Jewish history. The remnant was left here, there and everywhere. They were that little bit of hope that God left to blossom and to continue his work. So here we have a dark, dark book so far. And I'm quickly looking at the clock. And yet, we find in the middle of it this beautiful picture of somebody who in his distress is able to sit down and focus on God. And for the Lord will not reject forever, in verse 31. Although he causes grief, he will have compassion according to the abundance of his steadfast love. For he does not willingly afflict or grieve anyone. So he's just capturing the character of God, this positive side to it, that God, he's been angry with us. He's allowed a lot of nasty things to happen. But he's a God who is righteous, a God who will, in the end, sort of draw something positive out of it. So here is something beautiful. I hope you'll forgive me for this, but I'm going to pinch a bit. There's a book that Spring Harvest was using this year or selling about the Beatitudes, and I grabbed hold of a copy. I just read the foreword of it. I thought, wow, this is this picture here. Because what it is, the foreword's by a guy called Sam Ward. And he decides he will go to Manchester and he'll sort of become poor so he could work with the poor people on this housing estate in Manchester. And he goes there and the first thing he does is unloads his car. He realises that all he's doing is moving his riches into a poor community. He's sort of not really getting alongside them. But he goes on to say that the first guy he ever led to Christ just happened to be a young Iranian Muslim. And he worked a local kebab shop and he would share with him. One day he shared the gospel with him and he responded to it. And this lad started going to church. He got threatened by the local community, got assaulted by them. And at the same time, the government was trying to kick him out back to Iran. And sadly, that did happen. He went to Iran and he was arrested on arrival. And he went through the usual thing of being tortured, imprisoned, and things like that. And Sam actually spoke to him a few times on the phone, and he turned around to him one day and he said, would it have been better that you sort of pretend you're not a Christian, to keep your faith under wraps, to hide it to save yourself from all this beatings and punishment you're going through. And this reigning guy turns around and he says, how can I? All I have is Christ. And this is the picture I see here. You know, in the depths of despair, he's just crying, says, yeah, all I have is God. They've got nothing else to hang on to. And despite God being the one who's sort of put them in this situation, what more do they hang on to than God? So I just find that part so uplifting. Yeah, it's that bright shining light that gets you excited, thinking things can only get better from here. Things are going to be wonderful. But it goes downhill again. I'm sorry about that. Then talks about other things that happen. Talks about my eyes flowing with rivers of tears. A real pain, a real grief. What is going on? What is going on? In verse 55 again, it says, I called on your name, O Lord. From the depths of the pit, you heard my plea. Do not close your ear to my cry for help, but give me relief. You came near when I called on you. You said, do not fear. And you know, this picture of calling out to God, of recognizing that God is there, even if you just don't sense it, you know, even if you think God has left you, he cries out to God and God speaks to him and says, do not fear. What comfort he must have got from that. It goes on, but what's interesting is at the end of chapter 3, verse 64, he starts talking about paying them back for what they've done. And according to the works of their hands, give them anguish of heart. Your curse be on them. Pursue them in anger and destroy them from under the Lord's heaven. So, yeah, so somewhere out of this dismay and this pain and this sort of finding God, he has time to think, well, God, they've really been a nasty, mean lot to us, and I think you ought to pay them back as well. So the book goes on, and I might sort of just jump through a couple of things, but it goes back into chapter 4 and talks about vivid, disturbing things that are happening in Jerusalem. Again, he focuses on things like the tongues of the infant stick to the roof of its mouth for thirst. The children beg for food, but no one gives them anything. And then later on it says, happier are those pierced by the sword than those pierced by hunger. And it's just got this picture again of such a horrible, horrible place. But in verse 6 it says, for the chastisement of my people has been greater than the punishment of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment, though no hand was laid on it. You'll all know the story of Sodom and Gomorrah and how God punished them. And what he's getting at here is simply this, that Sodom was destroyed in an instant. The people, in a sense, didn't suffer the way these people are suffering in Jerusalem. Their suffering is prolonged. Their suffering is going on and on and on. And he's saying, yeah, happier are those pierced by the sword than those pierced by hunger. Just that cry out that, you know, it's much better to die quickly than suffer in such a way. The Lord gave full vent to his wrath. He poured out his hot anger and kindled a fire in Zion that consumed its foundations. So again, we're coming back to this picture of God, his anger. Comes back to the picture of the prophets and what they had done to bring God's anger. And we quickly skip on to chapter 5. And chapter 5, it breaks away from the pattern that we've been used to. And some people suggest it's because the poet just couldn't find the words to put against each letter of the alphabet and just gave up. But it starts off, "Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our disgrace. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our homes to aliens." And it comes back to this picture that, you know, they've lost everything. They've lost everything. There's been suggestions that the people that were left in Jerusalem in the area would have been the poorest people anyway, and that they perhaps wouldn't have noticed the difference as much as the rich and the wealthy, because they didn't have that much to lose. But in chapter 5, it talks about, again, the fact that they're struggling just to exist. They're struggling just to get food. They're struggling to get anything of worthwhile to keep them alive. In verse 10, I actually mentioned this verse in front of a group of people. I didn't know whether I should say it, because it says, "Our skin is black as oven from the scorching heat of famine." And there's a couple of Indians sitting there, and I smiled at them, and maybe I shouldn't have done that. But they didn't take any offence to it. But this is just talking about the fact that they are being burnt in a sense. But apparently, when you're starving and sort of slowly dying that way, your skin does go dark colour. So again, we've got this picture of the negative things. Women are raped in Zion, virgins in the town of Judah. And it just goes through again, just saying how things have just totally fallen apart. And we get through to verse 19. It says, "But you, O Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures to all generations." Again, suddenly his focus turns back to God, back to sort of seeing that, yeah, that there's this bit of hope somewhere in what is going on. Perhaps he suddenly realizes that God's nature does not change. God's nature does not change. And that perhaps that there may be something that God is going to do to draw them out of this situation. "Why have you forgotten us completely? Why have you forsaken us these many days?" Yeah, this cry out to God again about being left, about being forgotten, about being just sort of cast aside. "Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored." And in that, it's something that they suddenly discover, that they can do nothing themselves. This restoration, if it's going to happen, it's got to be purely God's decision. It's got to be purely his choice. And he has that choice to do what he wishes. And you get right to the end. Verse 22 says, 21, 22 is, "Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure." And you get to the end of this book, and most sort of bits of scripture you read, you can sort of perhaps see something positive at the end. We all like a good story with a nice bright ending, but this ends again back in this sort of, well, God, it's really up to you what's going to happen. Yeah, have you rejected us utterly? Have you cast us aside completely? Are you going to do anything to draw us back? It is totally up to you. We are in your hands. And apparently, if you read this in the synagogue, you then have to read verse 21 again, because they don't want it to end on this down, negative, doom and gloom bit. So you go back and say, "Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old." That's a lot more positive, isn't it? And that's, so, you know, in synagogue, that is what they do. But you know, this whole book is, if you read it, you might start to think of things like concentration camps and what happened there. You may get pictures of that in your mind, and you capture something that God has allowed to happen to his chosen people. Perhaps it's something that, you know, we would struggle to understand, but it's not out of a desire to let it happen. It's out of the fact that they have failed consistently to follow him for years and years and years. It begins with a disaster. It concludes with a negative picture of, you know, will God do anything, or have we been finally rejected forever? And that, I hope, has been encouraging to you. You know, the doom and gloom bits perhaps are a bit negative, but right at the centre of it in chapter 3 is that really positive bit. Looking to God is perhaps the one thing that we ought to remember to do when we find ourselves struggling. God is always there, and just cry out to him and he will hear. So, Graham, I better hand over to you.